For today's episode, we are so excited to have the opportunity to talk with Dr. Sharon Megdal, Director of the University of Arizona Water Resources Research Center, which is actually a sister center to our own California Institute for Water Resources. Sharon is also a professor and specialist in the Department of Environmental Science, as well as a CW and Modine Neely Endowed Professor and Distinguished Outreach Professor. She aims to bridge the academic, practitioner, and civil society communities through water policy and management research, education, and engagement programs. The geographic scope of Dr. Megdal's work ranges from local to international on issues ranging from water management, policy, and governance in water-scarce regions to groundwater recharge and transboundary aquifer assessment. We are so excited to have Sharon here. And this is a kind of a cool guest because we all have, and this actually, I think, speaks to who Sharon is and just what how many spaces she has expertise in, and that we have all kind of interacted and touched Sharon in different ways, right? We've all worked with her in different ways and have like different experiences of her. And she's such an amazing person. And I think I'm really excited because she's a really fun character too. And yeah, Faith, Sam, I don't know if you want to share, you know, any experiences or interactions you've had with Sharon and her work.
Yeah, so I first met Sharon, I guess, when I started working for the Water Institute, and we were at a National Institute for Water Resources meeting a decade ago or so. And I will say, in a very heavily male-dominated space, Sharon was, at the time, I think, the president of what we call NIWAR. And so it was really fantastic to meet her and have someone in such a strong leadership position. Over time, getting to know Sharon, it doesn't at all surprise me that she was in that kind of leadership position, as I now know her as someone who is a leader in lots and lots of different sort of spaces, as you've said, Malika. So I'm really looking forward to having this conversation with her today.
What I really like about seeing Sharon in those leadership spaces in the water world as oftentimes one of the only women is I feel like she shows you how to do it too. You know, it's like, here is a leader who is a woman who is also a badass and knows so much. And I just really like her style of leadership and the way that she interacts with people. She's wonderful at inviting people in, inviting young women in. And then also, like, I've seen her just kind of, you know, very expertly move things away from certain topics that aren't productive and kind of shift the energy of a room. And I really, really appreciate that about her.
Actually, as a part of the Permanent Forum of Binational Waters, community of practice that Rosario Sanchez and I and others, we have put together. Sharon has been a key person to lean in to ask for some guidance comments. She has always been a good support of this community of practice group. And I also like that part, that she always tries to bring this key comments or to the point comments. To some people might be difficult to tiptoe into some of those, but she really goes at them and talks to them openly. So I'm really looking forward to talk to her.
The other thing to note is that we are virtually traveling to Arizona today. And though Sharon's expertise is global and includes California, I think actually Sharon, I've learned so much about California from Sharon. She has a kind of a unique perspective just because she knows so much about water management in semi-arid and arid regions.
I do think that it's also good to think of, water in California and generally in the United States from a perspective that comes from outside of California. Sometimes we get this kind of very narrow vision about some of the things that are happening here. And it's good to also bring someone that is related, but not so closely related with water in California, that can bring in a fresh look at what we're doing.
Well, and certainly when it comes to like the Colorado River, the fate of California and Arizona are extremely intertwined. And so I think, you know, it's really, really important to be talking to folks like Sharon, who, you know, is both just a very charismatic as you said, Malika, no-nonsense leader, but also just has such a depth of expertise over a long career on these really critical issues.
Well, I'm so excited to have Sharon on the podcast with us. Let's talk to Sharon. Welcome to Water Talk, Sharon. We're so excited to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me on. I'm excited to be here.
So we have so many things that we want to talk with you about. And before we kind of get into it, we just want to start by hearing a little bit more about your work and your career path. So how did you get started working on water?
Well, that's a really interesting question because my pathway to working on water is quite different from many, particularly those in academia. So I grew up in New Jersey, by the way, and I always like to, with my students and audiences, get a sense of where they're from because that tells you something about the mindset of somebody. You know, did they grow up in a water scarce region or water rich region? And I went to higher education all in New Jersey. I did my undergraduate at Rutgers in economics, and I did my PhD in economics at Princeton University. And it wasn't like UC Davis, where you have resource economics and agricultural economics. It was kind of straight, what I call straight microeconomics and econometrics. Environmental economics was just at its start as a subfield. And I tell the story that in graduate school, probably the only time I mentioned the word water was to drink it. It's not what I focused on. Instead, I focused on the economics of government tax and expenditure policy and econometrics, which is the kind of mathematical statistical modeling subfield of economics. And I moved to Arizona and I was in the economics department. And again, I wasn't doing anything relating to water except serendipity, life changes happen. And I was appointed by then Governor Bruce Babbitt to Arizona's utility regulatory body. In California, it's called the Public Utility Commission, I think. And that's where I got my first exposure to water resources because we regulated privately owned water companies. Twists and turns and other things, and I'm not going to tell you the whole story because we'd spend the whole interview on that. I became the director of a regional water augmentation district. And the reason I was invited to apply for that position was because they wanted someone who understood not just the engineering of water, which I really wasn't an engineer, but instead kind of how to work with the people and figure out how to plan augmentation projects, plan, put together a plan. And so I really got my feet wet, and I'm saying that deliberately, in water through the very practical, through heading up a regional district, dealing with legislative issues relating to our water, our authorities and how we operated. And it was after being away from academia for 15, almost 16 years, that I was actually recruited to come back to the University of Arizona at the Water Resources Research Center, first as associate director and then soon after that director. And so I really got my feet wet and got immersed in water from the practical side. And then I came back to academia as an extension specialist in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences, you know, very different from kind of where I started. And that's why I do the kind of work I do, which is bridging the academic and the real world of water management. And what's really driven me as a professional, and it took me quite a few years to figure this out, is really policy. I'm kind of a policy wonk. And in the early years, it was how do states support school districts in their state, you know, public expenditures. And then it became, how do you set utility rates? And now it's kind of, well, how do you set water rates? How do you manage water resources? And so I'm applying my trade of being an applied microeconomist to water in a way very different than I ever expected, doing work that's very different from that I would have expected to do. I often say, economists may chuckle at this, I don't write in Greek letters anymore because that's what economists do when they get PhDs and they're in academia. So it really is a somewhat circuitous path that I took that I never could have imagined I would follow coming out of graduate school, going into graduate school, even in my early years.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing that, Sharon. I also took a very winding sort of in and out of academia practitioner path, and I'm very, you know, keen on understanding this work through practice. So I really appreciate hearing that about your story. So you spent some time as the popularly elected director for the Central Arizona Project, something that is coming up more and more, and I think is great for people to hear more about. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about your role as the director and kind of what you're most proud of accomplishing there, and maybe what you wish you'd been able to accomplish.
Well, let me tell a little bit about the Central Arizona Project. So the Central Arizona Project is a 336-mile constructed canal that pushes water uphill from the Colorado River near Lake Havasu in Arizona up to Phoenix and then further up to Tucson. And it's a concrete line canal. And California is very familiar with large constructed projects. And it was established to deliver part of Arizona's allotment of Colorado River water into Central Arizona. And it's governed by a 15-person board of directors, and they come from the three counties in the service area of the Central Arizona Project, which are Maricopa County, home of Phoenix, which is the fifth largest city in the United States, and Pinal County, in between the Maricopa County and Pima County, where Tucson is, which is where I live. Pinal County is a mostly agricultural county, and then Pima County, where the University of Arizona and Tucson are. And the board members are elected countywide, and I ran for two terms for the CAP board representing Pima County. The terms are 6 years. It's an unpaid board position. But so the board is 15 persons. There's a general manager. Our job is to hire and oversee the general manager and the policy. And here's where the utility experience comes in. We set the water rates and we set taxes. The board has some taxing authority. And it's a very important board because it's a large water project, and it's providing wholesale water supply to cities, to tribes, to industries, to agriculture. And it has had to deal over the years with many issues, including during my 12 years, issues like what to do about Navajo Generating Station, which the Central Arizona Project did not own any of, but it was providing over 90% of the power used to push the water, with the Federal Bureau of Reclamation owning that part of the plant. And first it was trying to keep it open, and then it was, well, it's going to be shut down because of things changing. And so that energy water nexus was really very important during part of my term. And then what's in the news every day, including the day we're doing this interview, is what about the shortage conditions on the Colorado River? It's over allocation. What are the implications? And how do we address things in light of shortage conditions and competition for water resources? And in particular, in Arizona, one of the responsibilities of the Central Arizona Project, and this may be unique across the country, is to operate this groundwater replenishment district that facilitates growth in the central part of the state. And I bring that up because that's a thorny issue for the Central Arizona Project Board. And for the entire 12 years I was on the board, I was on the committee that oversaw the Central Arizona Groundwater Replenishment District. And for 5 years, my last 5 years, I was chair of that committee. So to your question about what am I proud of or what do I feel good about, I really feel like I contributed regularly to good decision-making and good debates. A lot of our votes were not contested votes, but a lot of discussion would go into the votes or the debate before the vote, regardless if it came out unanimous or not. And we had issues where I was not on the prevailing side. You just have to vote with what you think is right. And so I think it was, first of all, very gratifying to do that kind of public service. It was also a great way for me to keep on top of things. over the years, I've done a lot of public service, a lot of board service, and I always look for things where I can contribute, but also I can learn. And serving on the CAP board was a great opportunity to learn, to keep up to date, to get additional insights into kind of some of the, let's say, challenges, the relationships that can sometimes get strained. And so I feel like I was an active member of the board. I contributed in many ways. When I was a board officer, that meant I went back to DC and we met with congressional delegations and so forth. So that all was very positive. I did decide not to run for a third term because I thought 12 years was quite a lot. I wasn't sure I was up for another 6 years. So I didn't run back in 2020. That's when my term ended. As far as, let's say, unresolved business, the challenges just continue. And in a way, I wish I could kind of be in the middle of it again instead of watching from the sidelines. But on the other hand, you make decisions and that's all fine and good. There are great people now on the board taking care of it. Some of those issues related to that groundwater replenishment function that I mentioned that are really thorny, really tough, and they're not only for the board itself to resolve. That function is legislatively approved and it really involves legislative input. And I wish we could have had a more robust discussion about what to do and what the pathways to resolving some of the issues. And some of the issues are that the membership is open as long as you pay your dues. And so this entity keeps getting more and more replenishment obligation, yet the water to perform the replenishment may be harder and harder to obtain. And so there's a challenge in kind of what water sources will be used to meet the replenishment obligation. What will the cost of that be? And then also in the actual performance, the functioning of the entity either acquires storage credits already accrued and then extinguishes them, kind of retires them to meet the replenishment obligation, or they got to find water to perform the replenishment obligation. And what this is all about is Arizona groundwater laws say you can't keep growing on overdrafted or mined groundwater. And so if you're going to rely on pumped groundwater, it needs to be replenished. And how it's replenished and where it's replenished, there are some issues relating to that that still need to be worked out. And those issues still remain unresolved.
But, you know, that actually kind of leads really nicely into our next question. It seems to me like California could potentially have a lot to learn from Arizona in terms of the logistics of this thing, right? Because what you're calling replenishment, we could call it recharge, right?
Yeah,
right. So we're using very particular terms in California. We're saying managed aquifer recharge. But managed aquifer recharge, or what we're calling that in California, is happening all over the world. It's been happening for a long time all over the world, and it's happening in Arizona in the name of this replenishment that you've described. And it sounds to me like what you're describing as the system of crediting and how to like logistically figure that out, you know, with agriculture is more, maybe more further along and worked out than where we currently are here. It goes by so many names. And as someone who spent time in multiple places, Arizona, internationally, that are doing some form of intentional recharge or replenishment, you know, what do you think that we can learn in California from some of these other implementations?
That's a great question. And you're absolutely right that people use different words sometimes for the same things. And then sometimes there may be nuance to the wording used. So for example, and I might start to sound a bit professorial here, and I'm not going to go into a 50-minute lecture on managed aquifer recharge in Arizona, but Arizona has had a statutory framework for storage and recovery, or recharge and recovery, for many years. Started out in the mid-80s, got redone in the 1990s, 1994 to be exact. And so we've had this regulatory statutory framework carried out through the Arizona Department of Water Resources for permitting storage facilities, the storage of water itself, and the recovery of that water and the accounting for the storage. So it's been a very well-defined, good system. I've written about that. And that's some of what I do is I try to look at what's going on in water management and help people understand what the management framework is attempting to do, where there might be rooms for improvement, and how it could be extended to other situations. So when I earlier used the term replenishment, that's a very specific function that depends upon the recharge framework. It's where you're replenishing groundwater that's been used by members of a replenishment district, and you use the recharge statute. So you might recharge the water in advance, get a credit, hold on to that credit until somebody comes to you and says, oh, I need replenishment. You need to do the replenishment. So replenishment has a very special connotation. Managed aquifer recharge, it's really interesting. Arizona doesn't use that terminology. I mean, that's terminology recognized across the whole world, and yet we call it recharge, or we call it aquifer storage. And then it even gets more interesting than that, because I've argued that with all the attention in California on AGMAR, agricultural managed aquifer recharge, we've been doing AGMAR in Arizona for many years now. I mean, 25 years or more. I mean, actually, I was involved in a project when I headed up to this regional augmentation district back in 1993 that was an agricultural recharge project. So we're getting on 30 years. We call it now groundwater savings. We don't call it AGMAR. And even now with California's FloodMAR, again, that's a particular kind of instance or application of managed aquifer recharge. And so what I would say regarding California, you know, we all learn from each other. And that's one of my big tenets of what I do professionally is sharing lessons learned, both positive and negative, right? So what's worked, what hasn't worked. So I think we learn from each other as states. Clearly, California looked at what Arizona did in groundwater management when it adopted SGMA, the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Clearly, you didn't want to include some of our weaker parts of that, and we do have some weaker parts of that, but look to some of the stronger parts. And I think we have the opportunity to watch what California is doing. It's still being implemented, as you all know, and see, okay, what's worked and is California able to accomplish its groundwater objectives? I think from Arizona's point of view, a couple of important lessons have come through. And one is having a strong regulatory framework, a strong permitting framework, a strong accounting framework, so people know what goes in, what counts, what doesn't count, what could come out. I think that's an important lesson learned from Arizona. I also think that Arizona's a good example of showing how it does pay to store water when it's available for times when it's not. And we've done that in a major way through the Arizona Water Banking Authority, which was established in 1995, to store Colorado River water when it was available. We weren't able to use so much of it at that time, wish we were in that position now, but we're not. And store it for the future in the aquifers. And that's really served us well. That's been maybe a 10-year or more than 10-year store now, recover later. But it's very similar to recognizing that you have flood water, you want to store it, you want to have it available for when you use it at a different point in time.
Sharon, when I'm hearing you talk, I want to ask a probably naive question, which is a little bit about this concept of like wet water. And so when you're talking about replenishment and sort of a system of accounting and credits, in my mind now I'm starting to get very confused about physical water. And then also, you know, when you're calling something a water bank, does that lead directly into sort of a water market? You know, it just the way that all of these things are starting to get kind of mixed up for me as we talk about this. Could you clarify?
You know, it is really important to ask questions about what this mechanism does and not just let yourself make inferences based on the words used, right? And so dealing with the distinction between paper water and wet water, that's a huge issue for us in Arizona because we allow for accounting on what we call an active management area basis. In Arizona, we've been doing groundwater management on the basis of legislatively designated active management areas, AMAs. Some of them are quite large. And so we have the Phoenix AMA, and it covers the city of Phoenix and actually very large aquifer with some sub-basins within the aquifer. And a lot of the accounting is done on an AMA basis. So if you store in that AMA, you are enabled to recover in the AMA. But you have localized areas of pumping, and sometimes you have pumping going on in an area where there isn't any of the recharge going on. And so you're doing almost like a mass balance, like you're doing an overall mass balance of what's going in and what's coming out. But that doesn't mean there aren't holes or pockets where the water is getting drawn down and it's getting built up somewhere else. And so that is one of the things we've recognized in Arizona is we call it the disconnect between the recharge and the pumping. And it's very hard once you've got rules in place to then change the rules of engagement, because then you usually have some people who made plans based on the old rules and they're losers and all that. So that gets difficult. So we do have issues of there being recharge in a place other than where the pumping is going. And we have areas of localized drawdown as a result. We have other good examples, I have to say, where the withdrawals are where the recharge is going and things are much more in balance. But this question of wet water and paper water, that's a very important one. The other question about like, okay, what do we mean when we say we have an Arizona Water Banking Authority? What does that do? And you might think it's like a bank where you go, you borrow money, you pay for like interest on the money you borrow. And that's not how the Arizona Water Banking Authority operates. It's not what it was created to do. And what it was created to do was store water for future times of shortage or outage of the Central Arizona Project Canal, meaning there would not be surface water delivered to Central Arizona. And then also for firming Indian water settlements. And in Arizona, we have 22 tribes located in Arizona. We've had a number of tribes that have had water settlements. In many cases, those water settlements depend upon some water deliveries through the Central Arizona Project, and that cannot always be guaranteed. And so there's what's called firming going on to kind of bolster those supplies through storage to be recovered in times when the deliveries are not made. And so it's that sort of activity as opposed to a market mechanism where, hey, we've created a bank. Now you can go and buy some of those credits. Now, interestingly, Arizona, just this last legislative session, reformed its Water Infrastructure Finance Authority. And it has some funds and some authorities now it has some funds and authorities now to augment water supplies. And how it's going to sell those and what it's going to do remains unknown to me. I'm not on that board and I've not been able to follow the details of it. It's only started meeting since late 2022. But we do not have a lot in Arizona in the way of market mechanisms. We do have some. And so it's very fair and appropriate for people to stop and say, hey, tell me a bit more about that. What do you mean by that? Is it a bank or is it something else? I think it's very appropriate that we need to stop and remember we're speaking to people who are not water experts and doing so all the time. And a lot of what I try to do is improve water literacy. And so it's always, always important to take time and try to explain the concepts.
And Sharon, something that you're mentioning that I think is good to put in perspective for our listeners is the different strategies that Arizona has already been implementing for a long time, that sometimes in California we're thinking we're inventing the wheel, but the reality is that it has been for a long time. Also, I think because of the condition, the natural conditions and also political conditions, thinking far ahead in the future. Well, here we are just kind of being reactive. Some of the water banks or the intentional storing of water from the Colorado Aqueduct into the future, it really thinks of how proactive Arizona has been doing it. Speaking of the Colorado, I mean, the Colorado doesn't end in San Luis Rio, Colorado, right? It doesn't end right at the border. It really goes further beyond, and you've been a great champion on the transboundary groundwater conversations between Mexico and the United States. So can you share with us and with our audience about the transboundary work that you have done between Mexico and the United States and some of these cooperative assessment frameworks that you have implemented?
One of my great pleasures over the last decade plus has been working on water and groundwater in particular at the U.S.-Mexico border. And the Transboundary Aquifer Assessment Program has been a cooperative effort between the United States and Mexico doing assessments of aquifers shared by the two countries and starting out with those for which there are sizable populations depending on those aquifers and or economic activities depending on those aquifers. And usually those go hand in hand, but having important economic or ecological activities going on isn't always associated with large populations. And this work has been done in collaboration with the U.S. Geological Survey, with other universities along the border, particularly New Mexico State University and Texas A&M. California opted out of the Transboundary Aquifer Assessment Program back in 2006. When it was under consideration because of many reasons, including the lining of the All-American Canal was pending at the time. And there were concerns that talk about groundwater studies, you know, maybe that's not such a good idea. Anyway, California opted out. So California is the missing link of the four U.S. states that share the border with Mexico.
Thank you so much, Sharon. We just switching gears a little bit. We want to ask you more about your international work as well, which isn't always a part of a extension program, but you edited a collection called Shared Borders, Shared Waters, Israeli-Palestinian and Colorado River Basin Water Challenges, which was focused on these sort of semi-arid and arid systems and how science diplomacy can play a role in resolving these water, difficult, contentious water issues. So could you talk to us a little bit more about what we might be able to take away from the Israeli-Palestinian system and sort of what you mean by science diplomacy in this context?
It's interesting to characterize international work. How does that relate to being an extension specialist for the state of Arizona? I can explain that very well and without any difficulty whatsoever, because all of my international work is taking the experiences and the practices and the learnings here in Arizona and sharing those with others who want to learn about our systems. So if people are very interested in what's going on with the Colorado River, if people are very interested in what's going on with hearing about and learning about aquifer recharge in water banking in Arizona, in what's going on with groundwater management or lack thereof in the state, my international work is always connected to my work here in Arizona. And so it's again, establishing connections and relationships. I've learned about practices in Israel. I've met people in Israel. I can then introduce them back to people here, and they can then follow up and implement solutions like drip irrigation pilots and other things like that. But to the point of that book emanated from a workshop. And what gave me the idea for the workshop? My impression had been that there had been a lot of cross work across the Middle East and Arizona in particular on irrigation methods and water engineering and so forth. But what I didn't see was much cross-pollination, cross-fertilization on issues relating to policy and management. And so when I had gone over there and spoken at a conference and was working on some joint proposals, which never got funded, the joint proposals for research, it's like, well, there's all this opportunity to learn from each other on policy and management. So worked hard with some collaborators, got some NSF funding and a funding from a binational science foundation to do a workshop. And then a few years later, we issued this book. And there again, it was all about semi-arid to arid areas, water scarcity, reliance on that water for farming and food production, and growing economies, and some degrading environmental assets. And so the key thing was, what can we learn from each other in terms of these different conservation, regulatory, and so forth? And so bringing it forward, you know, California, your governor must have been, I'm not sure which governor it was, signed an agreement with Netanyahu, and you've had meetings and so forth. But what you need to understand, or what one needs to understand, is the regulatory regimes of the two geographies are very, very different. They're totally centralized in Israel. We're decentralized here in the United States. And so again, my work can help make connections, bring together panels, bring together people. And often these are not just one-time things. They're not like you're one and done, where you've had an experience, but then there's follow-up, and there's two weeks ago or so, a CEO of a drainage authority down in the south of Israel, hyper-arid, they deal with major problems of flash flooding, and the CEO was going to be in California for some meetings and said, I want to come over to Arizona. I gave him some names of some of the flood control district people here in Pima County. He met with them, spent a few hours with me. I took him out to a wetlands and recharge site. And for him, it was extremely valuable. And so this is what I'm doing and what I'm able to do. And the hard work of it is trying to keep up to date. The real hard work of it is things are changing just like they're changing for us here in California and Arizona. They're changing everywhere. And so it's like, oh, with COVID, I hadn't gone over to Israel for a while. I need to get over there. And I was there in October and I met with people to kind of ask questions about what was going on. Same thing with Jordan. I've been to Jordan many times, but I haven't been there now for 4 years. And so with the science part, so to the question about science diplomacy, coming from a university, we do have the ability to bring research, to bring deliberation of the academic type to the forefront of this. And it's got to be part of the foundation, but you always have to recognize and have respect for all the people who are making the decisions. And that's where I feel like through my CAP board activities, through the Transboundary Aquifer Assessment Program, I've done a bit of diplomacy myself. I've helped get the commissioners of the International Boundary and Water Commission in 2016 over to Israel-Palestinian territories in Jordan. I helped facilitate some involvement of some tribal leaders in the UN Water Conference of a few weeks ago. So it's sometimes I describe myself as a busybody, but not apologizing for it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And because at many parts of our careers, sometimes we are struggling with that specific moral compass. So we always like to finish our episodes asking you, well, if there is anything else that you want to share with our audience and how can we support the work that you are doing?
Well, I think we've talked about a lot here, so I don't know that I have any other little stories to tell. I'm sure I could think of some, and this has been great. I mean, I really appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. I think about, you know, supporting each other's efforts. I think in general, we do have to think about how can we help each other do more of our good work in a way that's manageable and doable for us. And I'll go back to kind of what I alluded to earlier, is there are just so many days in the week and hours per day. I work really, really hard. And there are often a lot of desires to have me or have the water center help with something. But my staff is very, very small. You don't have a large staff there. So we need resources. We need resources to be able to carry out our work. I sometimes say I need Sharon extenders. You know, I mean, I need giving me another money to supervise a grad student sometimes is great, but give it to me for 3 years so I can actually support a grad student through a program, or give it to me to hire at least 0.5 staff person, if not more, because one person can't manage everything and can't do everything. And so I think the way we could support each other is think about ways to collaborate that truly expands our ability to do work. That would be wonderful. If I had the wish list, it's like, okay, let's figure it out.
Thank you for listening to the Water Talk podcast. My name is Samuel Sandoval. I'm a professor and cooperative extension specialist at UC Davis.
I'm Faith Kearns with the California Institute for Water Resources in the UC Division of Ag and Natural Resources.
I'm Molly Kanoko, an assistant professor of soil plant water relations and irrigation management at the University of California, Davis. If you enjoy our show, please review, listen, like, and subscribe anywhere you get your podcasts. Find transcripts and additional content at watertalkpodcast.com. Original music by Paloma Herrera Thomas.